From Seattle, this is World Trade Watch on day one of the WTO summit. On today's program,
trade unionists, environmentalists, and other activists from around the world gather to protest the World Trade Organization's ministerial meeting.
We'll hear from global policy analyst Deborah Toler, an environmentalist from Ghana, and free trade advocates.
I'm Julie Light with Norman Solomon. All this and much more coming up on World Trade Watch. First, these headlines.
This is Philip Babbage with headlines from the WTO Ministerial in Seattle. Delegates from all over the globe are arriving in Seattle today for the opening of the World Trade Organization Ministerial Meeting. Meanwhile, thousands of protesters are converging on the city to directly challenge the power of the WTO. At issue are many interrelated concerns, including labor rights, environmental protection, human rights, and economic justice. The historic summit is shaping up as a pivotal confrontation that will help to determine the future of life all over the world in such areas as agriculture, labor, financial services, trade barriers, corporate responsibility, and democracy. Backers of the WTO say it should continue to promote, quote, free trade that leads to more prosperity for all societies. Opponents contend that the WTO helps multinational corporations to trample democratic decision-making in pursuit of cheap labor, market dominance, and maximum profits. This morning, WTO officials evacuated the convention center, where delegates are scheduled to kick off the ministerial. Officials say they found, quote, something suspicious, with no further comment. Delegates, activists, and NGOs are standing in the streets of Seattle outside the convention doors. On the eve of the WTO ministerial meeting in Seattle, the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions, together with its U.S. affiliate, the AFL-CIO, hosted a two-day conference on globalization and workers' rights. Critics of free trade invited WTO Director General Michael Moore to speak to the delegates. Moore told the trade unionists that labor's concerns with the WTO posed a false debate.
Poverty, not trade, is the main cause of unacceptable working conditions and environmental degradation. And the answer to poverty is more trade and more business, not less.
But the trade unionists from around the world disagreed. Bill Jordan, General Secretary of the ICFTU, pointed out that in many countries, free trade means a lack of labor standards.
In so many countries, too many of the workers we represent experience every day the negative effects of globalization. There is violation of trade union rights, use of child labor, even the use of forced labor for export production. The list of injustices is long.
In Seattle, where 80 years ago the first general strike shut down the entire city, labor expects to be taken seriously. A large march and rally is scheduled to convey a strong message to the WTO delegates on the first day of meetings. Tonight, steelworkers are scheduled to march through the streets of Seattle, denouncing WTO policies that they say have been devastating for the rank and file of the United Steelworkers of America. More than 10,000 union jobs have been lost due to dumping of steel on the market by Japan, Korea, Brazil, and Russia. Also tonight, activists are part of a worldwide movement on behalf of debt relief for third world countries. We'll march in Seattle. While poor nations are paying many billions of dollars in interest on loans from Western banks, a wide range of grassroots groups, churches, and labor unions have been calling for debt cancellation. Among those urging this step are South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu and Pope John Paul II. The World Trade Organization holds its first formal session of the summit tonight, but already highly visible protests are underway in Seattle. Last night, anti-WTO activists engaged in civil disobedience by occupying an abandoned building, an abandoned four-story apartment building. They took the action to call attention to the plight of homeless people in Seattle, as well as the protests of prevalence of poverty worldwide. That's it for news headlines. For World Trade Watch, I'm Philip Babbage.
It's being called the Battle of Seattle, a battle for the hearts and minds of the world's citizens as the WTO ministerial meeting opens here in the Pacific Northwest. Activists from around the world are gathered in Seattle for a week of protests, teach-ins, and other events. The corporate elite is also out in force, vying to influence the 5,000 trade delegates gathered for the WTO Seattle round. Joining us now is Deborah Toller, analyst on global economic issues for World Trade Watch. We are also joined by Theo Anderson. He's director of Friends of the Earth Ghana and vice chair of Friends of the Earth International. Welcome, both of you, to World Trade Watch.
Thank you.
Deborah, WTO Director Mike Moore told a gathering of international trade unionists that free trade creates prosperity and that ultimately benefits labor and working people. I'd like you to respond, but first let's hear from Mike Moore, head of the WTO.
Prosperity and peace, that to me is what the multilateral trading system can help bring about. I've never seen a contradiction between trade and labor, because I don't believe one exists. Open economies, imperfect as they are, have delivered more jobs, opportunities, and security to more people than the alternatives. Countries that have embraced openness and freedom have increased the real incomes of their workers, which in turn has raised labour standards and reduced poverty. Countries that remain closed remain poorer, underdeveloped, cut off from the world of rights and freedoms. And if I made any contribution to my country, it was to make the case that trade is about jobs and income, taxable income, to pay for our dreams of better health care and better education, look after those who are old.
Deborah Toller, Mike Moore would have us believe that a rising tide raises all boats. Is that true?
No, I think that the evidence, and it's very notable that he doesn't mention any statistics or any solid evidence. He speaks very much in generalities. The evidence has been in the 5 years that the WTO has been in operation in particular that we're seeing a race to the bottom. Race to the bottom between countries, with low-income developing countries sinking even further behind the more developed countries. But in addition to that, seeing workers and farmers in the developed countries also losing income, losing jobs.
What about Mike Moore's assertion that prosperity helps labor standards, helps human rights, that it, somehow it's poorer countries that are the main violators of human rights and labor standards, and that it's development and prosperity that bolsters those things?
Well, let's talk about this specifically in the context of the WTO. What has happened, the WTO is an organization that differs very much from its predecessor, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, which was known as the GATT. And it differs in a very important way, which is that the GATT involved negotiations between states, independent sovereign states, over trade in goods. The WTO procedurally is very different. And the procedure is important because the way the changes have been made in the procedures is dominated by transnational corporations. Transnational corporations are the ones who are setting the agenda for the World Trade Organization. By definition, they are interested in the pursuit of profit, okay? And the pursuit of profit takes precedence over what is good for human beings, for workers that Mike Moore would have us believe is a major concern, and of course, as Theo will talk about, over the environment and other issues. So because the nature of the World Trade Organization is so fundamentally different from GATT, the decisions are made in secret. There's no what we call transparency or openness, because most of the cases that come before it are brought by governments but are brought on behest of transnational corporations. Because the judgments that are made are final, there's no arbitration, and there's huge penalties that are implemented. All of those work against grassroots activists, against labor unions and others, half the time even knowing what is going on. But certainly it works against their ability to protect their interests. And we're seeing that in the groups that are here from all over the world to talk about, in very passionate terms, what has happened to them since in the five short years that the World Trade Organization has been in place.
Well, Theo Anderson, I had a question about the concept of internationalism. I know you have a lot of experience and background in the Third World, particularly in Africa. Yesterday, Mike Moore, the Director General of the World Trade Organization, when he spoke to union officials from around the world, emphasized that he feels the WTO is a continuation and extension of the very wonderful tradition of internationalism, that people care about everyone else around the world, realizing that we're interconnected and pursuing policies with that in mind. What does that analysis mean to you?
The analysis will be correct if we are talking about theory, because the whole theory suggests that countries will benefit based on comparative advantage. So, for example, United States will have the advantage of producing a particular good, whilst Ghana or Nigeria or Senegal will also have an advantage of producing a certain good. But when you look at how it operates in reality, it moves from the theory of comparative advantage to a theory of absolute advantage. For example, you have group countries in the South producing goods whose prices are determined by the North, and the North producing goods whose prices are determined by themselves. So this erases the whole concept of comparative advantage, that one side of the equation is producing goods, deciding the prices themselves, and then forcing another side of the globe to accept it, whilst the other side produces the goods, they export it to one side, and the other side decides the price. So the whole philosophy has been defeated. So in theory, yes, the concept of free trade will bring prosperity, but in reality, that is not what happens.
Yet we're hearing an argument from supporters of the WTO, including much of the mass media in the United States, that there are outmoded nationalisms that have to be swept aside, that barriers to global trade are really impediments to realizing that we're all on one planet and we will sink or swim ultimately together. How would you answer those in the United States who feel very strongly that in the long run it's going to be counterproductive to allow these trade barriers or discouragements of free trade, as they call them, to remain?
Let me tell you a story in Ghana. This whole argument was presented to a community people in Ghana that nationalism is no longer important. We have to look at globalization and how interdependence promotes prosperity and so on. And the question was that if that is so, why would you allow free movement of goods and services and not allow free movement of people? So that means that in theory, you are creating a situation that is uninhabitable for people in a particular kind, particular sections of the world, and using that resource to promote prosperity at another side. So people will ask you, if you want free movement of goods and services, then you should also allow free movement of people. Then in that case, we will understand the full concept of globalization.
Certainly you see that in this country with the U.S.-Mexico border and immigration policies. We're speaking with Theo Anderson. He's head of Friends of the Earth Ghana. Also in the studio with us is Deborah Toller, our special global economic analyst. Theo, let's bring this discussion very down to earth. Let's talk about what it means, and I'd also like to put this question to Deborah in a moment, but what it means for me and mine, you and yours. How do WTO policies, WTO rulings, and free trade policies impact farmers, rural communities? You're with Friends of the Earth. You do a lot of work around forests and agriculture. What does this mean for people's day-to-day lives in Ghana?
See, the difficulty with WTO and its rules and how it impacts people in Ghana is that in traditional societies or in a country like Ghana, when you have about 70% of people living in rural areas, their basic source of livelihood is attached to nature. So be it the water, the soil, the forest, and so on. And then you open up these resources for competition by multinationals. So you bring a company like Shell or DuPont or Cargill into Ghana, and they have access to all these resources. The implication is that such a multinational company is competing with poor people for basic natural resources like water. In most parts of African societies, they take water from the rivers. They take water from the streams. And this is the particular resource that a multinational company will want to dispose its waste. And then it is argued that the government should treat the multinational the same way as it treats local companies, whose waste may be insignificant when you talk about pollution levels and so on. So in that situation, you open up such a resource to international competition, which is not very fair, and which runs counter to the very livelihoods of the people. So people see the whole WTO issue as issues that confront their daily livelihood, which I think is extremely dangerous for people who are already marginalized by the international economic system.
Deborah, what does it mean for communities in the United States?
Yes, I just wanted to add to what Theo said. The reason that this is a WTO issue is that, again, unlike GATT, the WTO takes up trade and services. So it's not just goods, but that's why the multinational corporations have so much more room to maneuver, is because they're involved in services like finance, telecommunications, et cetera. And that's why WTO rulings affect the kinds of issues he's talking about. In the United States, one of the arguments, particularly that the Clinton administration made, was that under WTO trade liberalization was going to result in every family in America having an increased income of $1,700 per year. And in fact, the trade deficit, because it was going to be based on more jobs based on our ability to export. In fact, the U.S. trade deficit has gone from something like $92, $94 billion when WTO was formed to over $218 billion. That's our deficit right now. So our deficit, trade deficit, is increasing. Jobs are being exported. Now, another important point for our listeners to understand is that the myth is that these are manufacturing jobs that are outdated and we're supposed to go over, you know, to Asia or someplace anyway, and we were going to keep the high-tech jobs. Excuse me, but the truth of the matter is high-tech jobs are being exported too. Computer programmers in India, excellently trained people in India, but they cost $9,000 a year versus $35,000 or $40,000 a year. So a lot of those technological industry jobs are being exported. And what we are finding is that the greatest growth in jobs in this country are in low-paying service sector jobs. So that's one group of people in the labor market. And, of course, the other group, and they're here in big numbers, are farmers. The family farm situation in this country, although it's portrayed as inefficient farmers or in other ways in the mainstream media, is very much related to what has happened with trade, free trade rules and agriculture, and they're being driven out of business.
Well, as they and others are being driven out of business and out of their livelihoods, we're hearing a lot in the media using, I guess, fairly broad brush terms, like the global debate going on in Seattle this coming week has already been framed as, among other things, a conflict between rich countries and poor countries. Yet aren't there, in a sense, third worlds within the first world and, in a sense, vice versa, elites in third world countries? And how does that shake out?
Yes, that's going to be it's going to be very interesting to see how these operate, because if you look at the WTO delegates themselves, most of them, including those from Africa, Asia, and Latin America, belong to an elite class and are pro-WTO. And then if you look at the activist community that's here, and they're here from Africa, Asia, Latin America, as well as Europe and the United States and Canada, and they represent another group of people. So the debate is very interesting. There are. But I do think, I mean, Theo did make a very important point about there being fundamental differences in the equation of power that takes place, because the fact of the matter is one of the debates that's taking place here is that many developing countries have been locked out of key negotiations within the WTO. They didn't even get a voice in what was sort of the setup for the meetings. And so that is an important point that shouldn't be lost in this as well.
Well, on that note, Theo Anderson, from what you know of the delegations that are representing the countries of the world here in Seattle this week, who do they represent when they come from a country such as Ghana? To what extent are they representing the elites of that country compared to the grassroots, more average population?
In the general sense, you would expect that any government representative will represent the interests of its people. And the same way that you expect that any representative of an NGO community will also represent the communities with which they work. But that is the theory of it. And most government representatives are already intimidated by U.S. positions or European Union positions, and therefore cannot advance their own arguments when it comes to positions which are not consistent with American positions or with European positions. And I remember just before we came here, we had a session for our Parliamentary Select Committee on Trade and also on Parliamentary Select Committee on Environment. And we were telling them for the first time the implications of the WTO. And we were surprised that they said to us that we know nothing about these implications and we have never been informed about these implications and we would want more information about that. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the reality of the situation. Our governments are giving the impression that the WTO is the tool that will bring them out of poverty. But in reality, that is not the situation. So they will want to sign on to such agreements, hoping that that will be the tool to economic liberation. But that doesn't work that way. So on one hand, you may have representatives that are advancing the cause in support of the WTO, hoping that genuinely it will bring those countries out of poverty. On the other hand, you can also have other representatives of government who believe that they only have to sing the tune of American European in order to receive development aid. So it's a very difficult situation to tell what sort of alliance that they have.
Theo, your work with Friends of the Earth focuses on the environment. Briefly, can you tell us what the environmental impacts are in a country like Ghana of WTO rulings?
When you have a ruling from an organization like WTO, the general macro-level implication is that you open up your markets to international competition. Now you have a small country that is producing to feed itself, and then you open up its markets for international competition, so you have a lot of importation of rice from Thailand or from wheat from Canada and so on. And what it means is that people are now encouraged to eat what they do not produce and produce what they do not eat. That means that a country like Ghana or Senegal or Nigeria will start devoting all its rich soils for export agriculture. So you'll be producing coffee, you'll be producing cocoa, you'll be producing cashew, you'll be producing pineapples for export. And then you leave all your marginal lands for the production of food. So that means that food production is also going down and down and down. And then the marginal source are becoming depleted and depleted. And the implication is that you use a lot of chemicals for export agriculture. And then the marginal lands cannot also produce the food. So on the first level, you have degraded almost all your soils. You have polluted all your waters with pesticides. And then the people cannot feed themselves anymore. So you have this interdependence, the dependence syndrome going back. People becoming poorer and poorer. People cannot feed themselves. Malnutrition is setting in. Waters are polluted. And then export agriculture also means more export of timber. And then also you liberalize your economy for investment in gold mining, aluminium, and so on. So this has a very serious consequences for the environment, both in land, water and air pollution.
One of the slogans of one of the largest agribusiness giants on the planet, Archer Daniels Midland, is that they're supermarket to the world. And so-called public television on PBS, the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, now has a series of what they call enhanced underwriter credits where David Brinkley is reading various message scripts that say there's plenty of food, the only impediments are barriers to get the food to the people around the planet. Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill and these other huge food marketers on the planet, what kind of role do they have in the third world and, for that matter, in the United States?
Yes, I mean, that's a really important point and it's going to be a hot issue this week. Yesterday, I just happened to be walking in Seattle and fell in with a group of farmers who were very sincere in saying, you know, we're just here because we're tired of what these multinational seed companies are doing to us. We have a limited number of places where we can buy seed. They're forcing us to grow crops that aren't marketable. They're forcing us to use, as Theo talked about, other inputs and pesticides and fertilizers and things that we know aren't good for our soil. And so they're here to protest. So you have American farmers being totally in sync with what Theo is saying is happening with farmers in Ghana. These companies have made out like bandits, to put it bluntly, under WTO rulings, because they have been allowed under the rulings to, and one of the hot issues that we'll be talking about, I'm sure, later in the week, are these genetically modified organisms, to force farmers to use seeds and to get patent rights to seeds. And this is particularly true in places like Africa. It's called biopiracy, that people have been using for centuries. And now they want to put a patent on it and say that these same farmers have to pay a fee to use something that comes from their own culture and their own ways of growing crops. So in general, they have been able to put a stranglehold on the world's food supply. Another issue that they've been able to do is to push through the notion that countries can't stockpile food. We know parts of Africa and Asia are subject to periodic famines. They aren't allowed to do that. That means that when there is a famine or food shortages, they're able to say, okay, now we'll release the food, and, of course, it's going to cost a small fortune. That's a new phenomenon as well.
Theo, we just have a minute left, but you have a lot of international experience. You're here with a delegation from Friends of the Earth from all over the world. How do people in Ghana react to the fact that farmers in the United States are waking up to this, that we're suddenly looking at a worldwide grassroots globalization, that if there's a silver lining to this, people around the world are beginning to get on the same page about trade policies?
Generally, people are interested in any action that promotes social interest. And people are also saying that we should not only look at economic interest, but we should also look at moral and ethical principles as part of the whole trading system. You can have lots of food that can go around the whole world, but the question is how many people can afford even the transportation cost if it was free. So I think that most people in my part of the world are looking at the introduction of moral and ethical principles into the concept of trade. And I think that is very basic.
We've been very happy to be joined by Theo Anderson. He's director of Friends of the Earth Ghana. He's also vice chair of Friends of the Earth International. Deborah Toller is our global economic analyst. She'll be joining us throughout the week. Thank you both so much for helping us kick off World Trade Watch.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to World Trade Watch from Seattle, coverage of the historic summit. This series of programs is a co-production of the National Radio Project, Corporate Watch, and the Institute for Public Accuracy. For World Trade Watch, I'm Julie Light with Norman Solomon.
From Seattle, this is World Trade Watch on day one of the WTO summit. I'm Norman Solomon with Julie Light.
Stay tuned for a debate on what's known as free trade and a special investigative report on big money behind the WTO summit.
Supporters and foes of the WTO often sound as though they're describing two very different organizations or even very different planets. They often talk about each other, but not often directly to each other. Here in the studio on World Trade Watch now are two forceful advocates of very strong positions. Marino Marsic is Secretariat of the U.S. Alliance for Trade Expansion. He's also with the National Association of Manufacturers. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Bob Naiman is also with us. He's a researcher at the Center for Economic Policy Research, which is a public policy organization based in Washington, D.C. Well, for starters, how about if each of you tell us how you feel about this WTO event and what it signifies in terms of planning for the 21st century?
Well, we looked for progress in certain areas to emerge from this conference. We'd like a new agenda set for the WTO, lower tariffs, more openness and transparency in government procurement, services, less agricultural subsidies. So we're looking for progress.
And Marino Marsic, when you say progress, and I assume that means you envision a lot of prosperity and global steps forward, specifically, what would that mean, say, for the people of the United States coming out of the WTO ministerial here?
Well, trade basically means better jobs in trade-intensive sectors, that is, those with much exporting and importing involved. Average annual compensation is about $45,000. In less trade-intensive sectors, such as apparel, where there's not much importing and exporting going on, average annual compensation is $24,000. So there's clearly a gap there due to trade, and trade creates wealth.
Bob Naiman, trade creates wealth. Trade basically means better jobs. What do you make of that?
Well, to say that trade creates wealth or even to speak about free trade is to paint with far too broad a brush. Obviously, some trade is beneficial and some trade is not beneficial, or some trade would promote the public interest and some trade would not. The problem here is that the World Trade Organization has established a set of rules barring governments from adopting regulations that would encourage trade that would be in the public interest and discourage trade that would not be in the public interest.
What do you mean by trade in the public interest versus trade not in the public interest?
Well, for example, as people are becoming increasingly aware, the WTO dispute resolution panels have overturned laws designed to protect public health and the environment. We had the sea turtle case, the tuna dolphin case. These are cases where the United States had laws, the Endangered Species Act and the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which are designed to protect endangered species. The WTO found a WTO dispute resolution panel found that these laws were in violation of the World Trade Organization rules and had to be changed.
Marino Marsic, there are thousands of activists here from around the world protesting the WTO summit, saying that this is an organization that is undemocratic, that rulings on the environment, like the ones that Bob Naiman just mentioned, by the WTO have damaged the environment, have overruled sovereignty of nations and communities to protect the environment. How do you respond to that?
I've looked at all 85 WTO panel decisions. And in none of the cases actually involve the level of protection. The U.S. sets whatever level of protection it sees fit. At issue was discrimination. For instance, in the shrimp turtle case, we gave Latin American nations 3 years to comply with the regulations, while giving the four Asian countries, India, Pakistan, Malaysia, and Thailand, 4 months to comply. You can't treat other countries unfairly or unequally. That's all the WTO says. Set the bar, the environmental bar, as high as you want, but force both the foreigners and the domestic producers to jump over the same bar. Plain and simple.
Bob Naiman.
Well, this is obviously not the position of the environmental movement. The bar is being set and interpreted by an organization in which environmentalists, labor unions, human rights activists are totally unrepresented. These rules have been written by multinational corporations for the benefit of multinational corporations. And the agenda of multinational corporations is not to have any restrictions on their ability to make profits. For most people, that wouldn't be their top priority. Their top priority is protecting workers and the environment. So the question is, when these values come into conflict, which is going to predominate? And so far, the World Trade Organization is an organization which the interests of corporations predominate.
Marina Marsic, you are here representing the U.S. Alliance for Trade Expansion and also a very old institution, politically powerful for many decades, the National Association of Manufacturers. Do you feel that there's a significant gap between the interests of, say, environmentalists and therefore the ecology on the one hand and corporate America?
Not at all. Actually, I don't see any gap. I think poverty is the worst enemy of the environment. Trade creates wealth, and wealth is what cleans up the environment, not poverty and underdevelopment. If trade caused so much environmental damage, then presumably those countries that trade the least, like Ethiopia and Sudan, would have the best environments. Well, we know that's true, but that's not true.
Well, those countries have a long history of war and other things that affect the environment, not just trade.
Very much so. It's true.
Yeah, I would suggest that wealth, the creation of wealth, does not necessarily improve the environment. If you look at the history of the United States, go back 100 years, look and see what the conditions were in which the majority of people were living in terms of their wages, in terms of their working conditions, in terms of environmental standards. They were very bad. What changed that? It wasn't wealth. If you go back to the 1890s, there were plenty of rich people. There was plenty of wealth being created. What changed that was organizing, public protest, education, and lobbying, and creating laws and regulations and enforcement of those regulations that cleaned up the environment, that banned child labor, that put into government policy values that reflected the majority of the population and not the robber barons. And what we're seeing now is that multinational corporations have found an end run around that process of public regulation of corporations. And that end run is the international economy, which is largely unregulated. And the regulation, if you want to call it regulation, that does exist is the World Trade Organization, which is really a restriction on regulation. There's nothing in the World Trade Organization that says corporations have to pay living wages, that corporations have to respect the environment. All of the rules in the World Trade Organization are restrictions on governments. Governments can't do this. Governments can't do that. So it's completely the opposite of what you would want.
I'd like to ask you both to address the question of whether the World Trade Organization is really a departure. I mean, did anything significantly significant change happen in the last 5 years, or is this a continuation or intensification of more or less what's been going on for decades or even centuries in terms of world trade and relationships between various countries and economic interests?
I would say there was a significant break. I mean, obviously, some of the trends that people think about in terms of globalization did not start 5 years ago. You know, capital flight outside the United States, corporations trying to find cheapest labor around the world, trying to evade regulations. What changed was government policy, a major shift in government policy to support and encourage that process. And so, for example, if you look at the transition from the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, to the World Trade Organization, the GATT was a largely voluntary body that reflected the sort of existing norm of international relations. Where countries get together, they try and agree, they try to operate by consensus. What happened to the World Trade Organization is setting up a real enforcement mechanism that says, okay, well, here's the agreement, and if you don't abide by the agreement, you're going to be punished. And that represents the really huge shift that took place between the GATT and the WTO.
Marina Marsic.
It's really more a question of pedaling a bicycle. Slowly but surely, we've made progress over 50 years to the point where right now in the U.S. We have a booming economy, a significant portion of which is accounted for by trade and exports in particular. We estimate about 25-30% of growth in this decade is due to the trade picture.
You're listening to World Trade Watch. In the studio with us are Marino Marsic. He's with the U.S. Alliance for Trade Expansion and the National Association of Manufacturers. Also, Bob Naiman of the Center for Economic Policy Research. I want to encourage you guys to mix it up a little and respond to each other and not just to the questions. But briefly, I wanted to quickly ask you, Marina Marcic, are free trade policies getting to be a harder and harder sell in this country? Polls show that a majority of Americans actually oppose WTO and unbridled free trade.
I don't think so. The summit has brought greater scrutiny to the WTO, and I think it's well-deserved scrutiny. We welcome it, because if you look at the WTO and how it operates, you realize that it is an open, transparent body, and that has brought enormous benefits to the U.S. economy. It's a win-win proposition for labor, environment, and the U.S. economy in general.
Yeah, two things. One is I'd like to respond on the economic question. Supporters of the WTO and the administration's trade policies generally throw around estimates like trade creates jobs, trade creates wealth, jobs in the export sector pay more. These indications are highly misleading. For example, it's true that jobs in the export sector tend to pay more than jobs on average in the economy. However, jobs in the sectors that are threatened by imports tend to have even higher wages. If you look at the academic research on the question of the impact of trade and globalization on wages, pretty much everybody agrees. I mean, including people that support the WTO, academic researchers that support the WTO, agree that that globalization of trade is responsible for roughly a quarter to a third of the increase in inequality that we've seen over the past number of years. So the notion that trade is good for the economy in the sense of like being good for ordinary people and what happens to their paycheck and their ability to make a living wage, that notion should not be considered, the truth, over and above the questions of environment and public health.
Marina Marcic.
In less trade-intensive industries, wages are lower on average, about $25,000 a year. In the high-intensive trade industries, wages are roughly $45,000 a year.
See, trade-intensive is misleading because that lumps together two things. Lumps together industries that are exporting with industries that are threatened by imports. And this is a general thing that you see a lot. People say, there's a great deal of trade. Well, okay, but, some of that trade is displacing American workers, for example. So it might be not considered a good thing by the workers who are losing their jobs. It's also important, I think, the whole notion of free trade in the WTO, a lot of the rules in the WTO are not about free trade. For example, the U.S. patent protections that are being imposed on the whole world, it's nothing to do with free trade, no basis for it in economics. It's just protecting corporate profits of the pharmaceutical industry.
That's an argument against the U.S. Patent Office and not an argument against the WTO. What does the WTO have to do with that?
Well, for this particular discussion, the clock on the wall says that we can't resolve it. We need to move on. We've been talking with Marina Marcic, who you heard most recently. He's the Secretariat of the U.S. Alliance for Trade Expansion, and he's also with the National Association of Manufacturers. Also with us, Bob Naiman with the Center for Economic Policy Research based in Washington, D.C. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Up next, investigative correspondent Prothap Chatterjee takes a look at the Seattle Host Organization. The city of Seattle is eager to make a good impression on the hundreds of trade ministers and their teams of advisors that are attending the World Trade Organization meeting in the hopes of attracting investment. All delegates have been given a special welcome package filled with samples of wine, salmon, chocolate, and coffee that have been prepared by the Seattle Host Organization, a group of corporations which is footing the bill for this week's events. Prothap Chatterjee went to meet with Ray Waldman, the director of the Seattle Host Organization, to find out about the corporate sponsors.
The bill for hosting ministers attending the World Trade Organization meeting here in Seattle this week is expected to top $10 million. This will pay for their transportation to and from the airport, telephones, computers, meeting rooms, and two banquets to welcome them and bid them farewell. Traditionally, this bill is paid for by the host government, but as Ray Waldman, the director of the Seattle host organization that is in charge of making these arrangements, explains, the United States government will not have to pick up the tab.
We got $1 million contribution from the state of Washington. The rest of the money is from private companies. Major companies like Boeing, my employer, and Microsoft were significant contributors, but we had over 100 smaller companies that contributed, and of course we had national companies that are interested in trade, U.S. companies that have an interest in trade. Among the biggest are, of course, companies like General Motors and Ford, Hewlett-Packard, Xerox, Allied Signal, Honeywell, major companies that have substantial interests overseas.
Corporate sponsors can contribute at different levels starting at $5,000. This earns them a mention on the Seattle Host Organization website and a chance to advertise their products in official publicity materials. But those contributing more than $75,000 get a special treat, according to Ray Waldman.
All of the sponsors who have provided $75,000 or more can attend that dinner. It's just a question of how many people from each sponsor, from each sponsoring company. That's a very small dinner, actually. I say small, of course. It's when you have 160 countries and many countries bringing more than one minister, you're entertaining quite a few people. But that is for government officials primarily.
This personal access to the ministers and their top aides can be very useful to multinational corporations like the Seattle-based Boeing, for whom Waldman works. He is the vice president for international relations for Boeing in Washington, D.C., where he is in charge of lobbying the United States government.
Boeing has a, you know, obviously has an interest in meeting with a large number of these delegates, and so we've offered tours of our facilities while they're here, and we're trying to make sure that we are good hosts for our foreign delegates. In the commercial jet business, almost 70% of our sales are made to foreign airlines, so it's a substantial amount. That's why Boeing pays so much attention to international trade issues.
According to Laurie Wallach, the director of Global Trade Watch, based in Washington, D.C., Boeing has another less publicized interest in lobbying the ministers of the World Trade Organization.
Boeing is very interested in the WTO's powers being expanded and as well more countries getting into the WTO. Because for Boeing, what it means is the right to have their planes made any place, the cheapest labor, the worst conditions possible. So they're not so interested in trying to sell things to other countries. They're interested in moving jobs to lower wage places where there's no future chance of people fighting to have a higher wage, for instance, by organizing a union.
Exploitation of low-wage workers is a hallmark of the other major sponsor of the World Trade Organization's meeting, Microsoft Corporation, which is based in Redmond, just outside of Seattle.
Microsoft uses prison labor. The state prison, 30 miles outside of Seattle, helps shrink wrap packages of software for Microsoft. So they've not only been involved in antitrust predatory practices that gouge the consumers, but they're also using prison labor and overseas labor to actually assemble and package and distribute their software.
Laurie Wallach, the director of Global Trade Watch, says that the role of multinational corporations in sponsoring the World Trade Organization meeting gives them an unfair advantage.
It's absolutely outrageous that a major international intergovernmental conference is being funded by corporations. The Clinton administration has literally privatized the biggest governmental trade meeting in America to a handful of big multinationals who have a direct interest in the outcome.
Wallach says the role of Ray Waldman, a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Commerce, as director of the Seattle Host Organization, is a conflict of interest.
The guy who's heading up the Seattle Host Committee, the corporate coalition, is the poster child of the problems of their so-called revolving door. He's a guy who was a negotiator and now is a big-time fancy lobbyist in Washington for Boeing. Now he's back here as a private corporation, theoretically doing the administration's job of holding a ministerial. In fact, this revolving door is going so fast, it's sort of unclear what hat he's wearing today, government, corporate, or both.
For World Trade Watch Radio, I'm Protheb Chatterjee here in Seattle.
Recently, AFL-CIO President John Sweeney endorsed a U.S. position on trade policy that calls for a labor standards working group in the WTO. Sweeney's decision sided the AFL-CIO with a coalition of business leaders and drew sharp criticism from various rank-and-file sectors of the U.S. labor movement. A joint WTO Labor Federation press conference, World Trade Watch host Norman Solomon challenged Sweeney on this apparent contradiction.
My question is to ask if you could clarify your position about the labor standards aspects of possible WTO actions this week. There seems to be a fairly widespread perception among people gathering in Seattle this week that you are content with the WTO possibly establishing a working group to produce a report on labor standards. And a lot of people seem to feel that you're essentially settling for tokenism, that this is a provision that could be adopted that Vice President Gore would feel comfortable with and that you would feel comfortable with, and that there's really no substance to what you would be getting as a leader of a labor organization. Well, could you address that perception and tell us what you think about it?
We are looking for a process that addresses the issue of core labor standards and human rights, as well as environmental and consumer protections, that's enforceable. We're not looking for any cosmetic changes or your phrase, tokenism. We're in this for the long haul, and we're in it to get meaningful rules at the WTO that address these issues. I don't know how much clearer we can be about this in terms of how serious we are about it. All of us have addressed this issue today as well as throughout the week, and it's clear that we want strong, enforceable, accountable process for core labor standards, addressing core labor standards. We have endorsed, the AFL-CIO has endorsed Vice President Gore. We firmly believe that it's an endorsement that will motivate our members to support him in the election. We firmly believe that he's the best qualified candidate presently running for president in the United States. We have a strong commitment from Gore regarding core labor standards, and that he will not sign any trade agreement that does not include core labor standards, human rights, consumer and environmental protections, as we have stated.
Concretely for this week, would it be fair to say you're satisfied or mollified to have a working group set up to produce a report, even though the working group would essentially have no power whatsoever?
Is that your position, or are you saying that's my? I'm making it very clear. We're not satisfied unless we get everything that we're asking for, and I don't think we can make it any clearer. How much we're going to get remains to be seen, and we're going to fight here in Seattle for as strong a process as we can get, and we're in this for the long haul.
World Trade Watch's Philip Babich spoke with Judith Barish, former communications director for the California State Labor Federation, about Sweeney's support for a labor working group.
Well, I have to say that I think this labor working group is a very tepid political compromise. It's designed by the Clinton administration to satisfy the labor movement that something is being done on labor standards without disturbing the business community, because in fact, it's unlikely that it'll lead to anything substantive. What's interesting to me is that the developing nations don't seem to realize what a toothless proposal this labor working group is. They think it's part of a U.S. plot with business and labor all involved to defend the U.S. market and to promote protectionism, which is not out of the question. But I think in this case, they're looking at the wrong animal.
Where should labor organizers and labor organizations turn to within the international arena if they want strong labor rights enforced?
Well, I frankly think it's unlikely that the WTO is ever going to be an organization that enforces strong labor rights. I have a lot of sympathy with those who think that the WTO is probably so flawed in terms of its democratic access or lack thereof and corporate control that probably no amount of tinkering in the form of labor standards will make it an organization that's friendly to working people. Unfortunately, for different reasons, the same could be said of the ILO, the International Labor Organization. The ILO passes a lot of conventions that are very pro-labor. However, it has no enforcement power whatsoever. It relies on purely voluntary sign-ons by member nations. And just to give one example, the United States has only signed on to one of the 7 core labor standards in the ILO. The other irony is that if any of the labor, those conventions of core labor standards in the ILO were actually enforced, they would be WTO illegal. So I don't right now see any good short-term prospect for labor rights being promoted in the international arena apart from international union organizing.
John Sweeney has used the phrase long haul to describe the effort that is required to get labor standards enforced, particularly within the WTO. What do you think about when you hear this phrase long haul?
I agree with Sweeney that we're not going to win any labor standards overnight. I think he uses that phrase, though, to bridge this gap between protesters outside the convention hall and labor officials being involved in reform proposals inside the convention hall. And there, I'm not so sure that working within the system is going to solve it.
Both President Clinton and John Sweeney talk in quite persuasive terms at times about workers' rights and supporting workers' rights. How has President Clinton delivered workers' rights to workers?
President Clinton has been more than competent at borrowing and making use of labor's language about the importance of workers' rights, working families, and the need to protect labor standards for workers in the United States and in other countries. Unfortunately, his actions at the WTO in past years have not given much substance to those claims. In fact, to the extent that workers' rights have so far been brought into the WTO language, it's been in the form of a negative way. In 1996, the United States was one of the countries signing on to a declaration in Singapore at the ministerial meeting then that explicitly excluded labor standards from any WTO, future WTO action. So it's very clear that workers' rights and the WTO are, you know, never the twain shall meet.
Judith Barish is former communications director for the California AFL-CIO.
You've been listening to World Trade Watch from Seattle, a co-production of the National Radio Project, Corporate Watch, and the Institute for Public Accuracy. Background information and lots of source material about the issues covered in this broadcast can be found on the web at corpwatch.org and radioproject.org. Call us toll-free at 1-800-529-5736. With co-host Julie Light, I'm Norman Solomon. Thanks for listening.